Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Malik Yakini. He is the executive director and co-founder of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network, which operates the D-Town Farm in Detroit, which is a 7-acre farm that grows more than 30 different fruits and vegetables, and he's very involved in the food movement, and we will talk more in detail about his work when he comes on in a little bit later in the show. But first, I want to just talk to you about some things going on in the news, some things that you might want to participate or and that I encourage you to participate in, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. First off, as we know, we have only a few days before it's time to vote, and I just cannot emphasize and express how important it is this midterm election that we all really get out and vote. Every day when I watch what's going on in the news, I am completely freaked out and really concerned of the direction that our policies are going and what's going on in our world. And I know that we can turn it around, but we need people power to turn it around. We can't allow the status quo to continue as it is. And so we all need to go out and get everyone we know out to vote so we can try to make some headway into turning this around. I just want to say that I stand in solidarity with the people of all faiths against hate. What happened last weekend in Pittsburgh is horrendous, as well as, you know, the shooting of a few random black people a few days earlier, which did not get much coverage. And then, it just continues this feeding into hate and white supremacy. And, we're just going in a bad direction. We really need to all, come together and turn it around. And it's really interesting, even within the food movement. I know for weeks now I've been talking about the Long Island Food Conference, which is coming up this Saturday at LIU Post on Long Island. And it's going to be a great food conference, and I'm going to tell you about it more in just a little bit. But one of the issues that has come up is in one of our policies, one of our panels is food as medicine. And we definitely have a doctor who will be there who promotes plant-based eating and, more vegan eating for health reasons. And then we have another speaker who promotes eating sustainably raised animals and raw dairy. And, we've gotten some phone calls of people that are vegans, who are a bit upset that this other person is going to be there. And it's just crazy. We have to all have tolerance for everybody's choices. What we do want to really encourage is to help educate everybody as to the impact and the global footprint that their choices have so that people can make better choices. There is a need for building up soil and replenishing our soil, which is being done, through biodynamics. It's being done in permaculture circles. But there is a symbiotic relationship also that happens when you have a farm where animals are grazing on the land, not where you have animals in feedlots being raised in inhumane ways. And there's information on all different sides, but the important thing is that whatever your choices are, you really follow where it's coming from and you follow its sourcing and how it is being produced. And, I just can't emphasize that enough. And at the same time, we need to listen to each other and we need to allow everyone to speak their truth, and through love and compassion and understanding, hopefully, and education, hopefully we can make changes so that everybody's making better choices. But the anger and the hate and the fighting just will not work. We're not going to get anywhere with that in whatever circle you are mobilizing, whether it's environmental, food, health, whatever. We need to be able to listen to each other and come from a place of love, not hate. And so I beg all of you to take that up and to get out and vote and see if we can turn some of these things around. You know, the current administration just has no respect at all for our planet and for the environment. Right now, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the governmental agency that is here to protect our environment, they're actually weighing the idea of allowing oil companies now to start dumping their wastewater into the rivers and streams. That, and the reason they're thinking of letting them do that is because right now they allow them to just, you know, dump them into deep wells in the earth, and they're now finding that that is polluting our water and our land, and they're running out of space. So they're now looking for more places to dump it rather than putting energy into renewable sources. They'd rather find another place to dump this toxic waste, and now they're looking into doing it into those rivers and the streams. And that is just a bad idea, and we just can't let that happen. And it's just one thing after the next of bad decisions that's happening within our government. And it's just really, really depressing. The European Parliament, on the other hand, they just voted to ban single-use plastic, which is a real wonderful thing. Of course, they have to find what they're going to start using as alternatives, because they're talking about plastic utensils and plastic straws and plastic plates and all these things that we here in America use all the time. You go into a deli, you take food out to go, everything's in plastic. You go to Trader Joe's, which, you know, sources things supposedly in a good way, but then they wrap it all in plastic. We need to find some alternative methods, and that's going to be a challenge. So one of the things that really has a place for growth is innovation. We need all the young people out there that are working and trying to figure out what they're going to do to make a living, to really start finding alternative methods for all of these things. Get into innovation and invent things that can help make our world better. That's what we need. Anyway, as I mentioned real briefly, this weekend is the Long Island Food Conference, which I'm really excited about. I've been a big participant in making this happen. We have a great keynote speaker, Francis Moore Lappe, who wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet back in the 1970s and was my inspiration, actually, to stop eating meat over 40 years ago. And she's amazing, and she's also co-founder of the Small Planet Institute, and she is not only someone that has been debunking myths for her whole career about myths like there's not enough food to feed all the people on the planet, but she is also going out there, when I talk about innovation, she's going out there and finding these pockets of hope, these places where people are actually doing the right thing and turning things around. And you know, it's not all, you know, dark and grim. There is some light out there, and we need to find that light, and we really need to expand on that light, and she will do that for us. So if you can make it to the Long Island Food Conference, it's going to be great. We have four panels. One is on food policy, Tom Colicchio, the celebrity chef and founder of the Food Policy Network, will be on that panel, along with Karen Washington, who is a great food activist and a community supporter right here in the Bronx. And I just saw her the other night at the Just Food Gala, and she's wonderful, and so I'm really excited that she'll be with us. Then we have a panel on food and climate change and how our food choices impact our climate and our global footprint. So that will be a great panel. Then we break for lunch. We have a catered plant-based lunch available for everybody who comes to the conference. And then in the afternoon, we have two more panels. One is Food as Medicine. I'll be moderating that. We have Dr. Robert Graham, who, as I said, is more on the plant-based side. And we have Sally Fallon Morrell, who is the founder of the Weston Price Foundation, who, you know, really believes that bone broth and raw dairy is the way to go. And then we have Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, who is an incredible, knowledgeable herbologist and know so much about pharmacology, botanical pharmacology, and using herbs and Chinese medicine. So she'll be with us. And then the last panel is on growing food, and we have representatives from Sangli Farms, which is a huge CSA organic farm here on Long Island. We have someone who will be talking about the cleaning of the ocean with aquaponics and raising fish that way and seaweeds. And then we have hydroponic representatives from Arrow Farms in Newark, New Jersey, which is a factory-sized hydroponic growing situation. And then we have someone representing community gardens. So it's just going to be a great day. If you can make it, please come. And then also, we are having a pre-conference screening on Friday night of a film called What the Health. And that's a really great documentary, award-winning film talking about how plant-based eating can really improve our health. And at the same time, the corruption and the this misinformation that we're being fed about some of the things that we are eating and the production of our food system. So we have a great weekend. So if you can make it, please, please come to either Friday night, Saturday, or both. And then Fresh Med, which is the organization service that Dr. Robert Graham has founded, they are having a holiday party on November 9th from 7 to 9. And you can register online at freshmed.com. And that's going to be a wonderful event with healthy appetizers for the first hour, fresh juice, and exercise and talks. And it should be a really interesting event. And if you do want to sign up, he's offering all of my listeners a 20% discount on tickets. The code is FRESH20. So just type in FRESH20 and you'll get a 20% discount on that. Woodstock Farm Sanctuary is having their Thanksgiving Vegan Gala on November 10th. It's an all-day event up at the Woodstock Sanctuary Farm. So look into that if you are interested in going to that. And there is also the 8th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference coming up from November 30th to December 2nd. And that's being hosted by Bionutrient Food Association up in Southbridge, Massachusetts. So check out some of those things. I want to share my weekly recipe with you before I invite Malik to come on. This is a stuffed poblano peppers with a cashew lime crema. And I had so many peppers in the garden and so many cherry tomatoes, I needed to create a recipe to use these up. So these are stuffed poblano peppers, and they just came out great. I started with 10 large peppers for stuffing, 1 onion chopped, 4 small elongated red peppers diced, 2 habanero peppers diced. And my suggestion is put on some little thin food prep gloves or rubber gloves when cutting up the habanero peppers, because they are really pungent, and if you get them on your hands and then you wipe your eyes or scratch yourself, you know it's really going to burn. So wear some disposable gloves. 2 cups of cherry tomatoes, 8 ounces of baby portobello mushrooms, 2 cups of chopped kale, 2 tablespoons chopped garlic, 1.5 teaspoons pepper, 1.5 teaspoons salt, and 1/2 teaspoon of pepper. I used 1 can of organic black beans, 1 cup of frozen organic corn, 2 cups of cooked organic brown rice, 1 teaspoon of cumin, 1 teaspoon of chipotle powder, 1/2 teaspoon of smoked paprika, chopped parsley or cilantro for garnish. If you have cilantro, you can also throw cilantro into the recipe. That would be great. I just didn't have any at the time I was making this recipe. For the cashew lime crema, I soaked 3 cups of cashews for 3 hours. You can soak them overnight or a little longer if you'd like. Then drain them. 2 cups of water, juice of 1 lime, plus I put in 3 tablespoons of lime juice that I had. If I had had more fresh lime, I would have used that instead. So if you have 2 limes, I would use 2 limes and just do the lime juice by taste. 1 teaspoon of chipotle powder, 1 teaspoon of salt. And then I did put a crumb topping over the whole thing, and I used a half a cup of unsweetened organic corn flakes that I had here and a half a cup of organic crushed tortilla chips. And I just crushed those up, and I sprinkled that over the whole casserole when I was finished. So for the crema, you're just going to blend all of those ingredients in a food processor or a Vitamix and then adjust the taste, you know. And I really, like I said, if I had a little bit more lime here, I would have used a little bit more lime. And then for the filling, you're going to start by sautéing the onion in some olive oil or whatever your favorite sautéing oil is. Add the garlic and the peppers and cook those for a few minutes until everything is soft. Then add the spices and let the spices, you know, cook a little bit by themselves with the peppers and onions and bring out the flavor of the spices. Then add the mushrooms and the kale and cook that for about 5 minutes until they're soft. Then add the cherry tomatoes and continue cooking until the tomatoes have broken down. And I actually took the back of my spatula and kind of squished the tomatoes so they would break down quicker. Then I added a can of beans and the cup of frozen corn. And again, of course, if you have fresh corn, go for that. But I don't, so I used frozen corn that I always keep in my freezer. Frozen corn and frozen peas are something that I always have in the freezer. Just sometimes I just want to add some bright greenness to my rice pilaf or something like that. It's great to have just in the freezer. But anyway, so I added the frozen corn and continued cooking for a few minutes and allowed the flavors to meld together. You can taste the filling. If you like things a little bit spicier, you can add a little bit more chipotle pepper sauce on spice or smoked paprika if you like it a little smokier. So don't be afraid to adjust the spices to your palate. And then you're going to stuff the peppers. So you're cutting the peppers in half. You're going to scoop out the seeds. I saved all the seeds and dried them because I will plant them again next year. Lay them out in a single layer in a baking dish that I sprayed a little bit with oil just to keep it from sticking. Then I filled each pepper with the filling as full as I could get them. And then I poured half of the cashew cream over the peppers and sprinkled the crumb topping on top. And I saved the remaining cashew crema to serve with the dish, kind of like, it's almost like a sour cream on the side. And that's it. You're going to bake that in the oven for about 40 minutes until the peppers are soft, and then you can serve it with a little bit more rice on the side if you like, or just some sauteed, you know, some salad, whatever you'd like. And again, serve it with that remaining crema. And it was delicious. So if you make the recipe, please let me know. I love hearing from all of you, and feedback is always great. So it's now my pleasure to introduce to all of you Malik Yakini. He is the co-founder and executive director of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. He operates the Town Farm, which is a 7-acre farm in Detroit that grows more than 30 different fruits, vegetables, and herbs. And I actually met him out there in Detroit many years ago and saw the farm myself. It's amazing. And the organization is also spearheading the opening of the Detroit Food Commons and the Detroit People's Food Co-op in Detroit's North End. And Malik views the good food revolution as part of the larger movement for freedom, justice, and equity. He has an intense interest in contributing to the development of an international food sovereignty movement that embraces Black communities in Americas, the Caribbean, and Africa. Malik, are you with me?
I'm here. What's up, Bhavani? How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine. It was wonderful listening to the details about the conference.
It's going to be a great conference.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, I ran into a bunch of people at the Just Food Gala this week who knew you and were excited that you were going to be on today. And It's so nice to have you back, so thank you.
Yes, thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
Great. So Detroit, since I visited, I don't know how many years ago that was, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, Detroit's really having a comeback. And what's your perspective on how that's all playing out?
That's a question I'm asked often. And what we often say in Detroit is that Detroit at this point is kind of, there's a two Detroit narrative. It is absolutely true that parts of Detroit are so-called coming back, meaning they're experiencing an economic revitalization. We're seeing tremendous amounts of capital being poured into certain parts of the city. We're seeing new restaurants open. We're seeing artists begin to come here from different parts of the United States and different parts of the world. But the problem with that is that the places that we see most of this happening are not coincidentally the places that are being highly gentrified, where we have lots of young, well-meaning whites who are moving back into the city. And there seems to be a development strategy that prioritizes these new residents and leaves the kind of long-time residents to languish. We don't see much of this development happening in the neighborhoods where the vast majority of Detroit's 80% African-American population lives. And so we really question this narrative of a comeback, because for most of us, we're not seeing a comeback. We're seeing kind of business as usual, and we're seeing other parts of the city which are bright and shiny and that are being touted as the signs and symbols of a comeback of Detroit.
Oh, that's so disappointing to hear, and yet not surprising. I mean, I've seen it in New York, you know, all the neighborhoods that are being regentrified, you know, whether it's, Bed-Stuy or, you know, all these areas that, you know, young white people are moving into and buying million-dollar brownstones, and, you know, and the people that used to live there no longer can afford to live there.
Yeah, you know, there's a certain logic to capitalism, and I want to be clear from the beginning that I am anti-capitalist. I think capitalism is a terrible system. But there's a certain logic that, first of all, presupposes that the way to spur economic development is to give advantage to people who are already very wealthy and to give them the opportunity to build things like stadiums or, you know, business complexes, with the idea that if these very wealthy people can build these large projects, that somehow the wealth that develops as a result of these projects will trickle down to the rest of us. I have seen no historical evidence that that kind of logic is true. One of the other major flaws in this kind of capitalist development scenario that we see playing out in most places throughout the United States is that it takes huge amounts of capital to build new buildings or to revitalize neighborhoods. And typically what happens is those who are deemed to be most capital ready, in other words, those who are in the position to be able to receive financing, are typically those who already have tremendous amounts of resources. For example, if you go to the bank and you say to the bank, I need to borrow $1 million to open a new restaurant, the bank wants to know if you already have $1 million in assets that they can use as collateral. And if you don't have that, you're probably not going to be deemed qualified for the loan. And so it's a self-replicating system where those who already have access to wealth are better positioned to get more access to wealth, and those who have limited wealth are in a position to get almost nothing. And so we're seeing all of those things play out in the city of Detroit.
Right. What answer or ideas do you have that might work? Like, how can we get some of that financing into the hands of the 80% of African people that live there who would like to use it? Or is there a way to engage partnerships so that they are being brought into the regentrification and are able to benefit from some of this new economic growth?
Well, short of kind of the long-term goal of dismantling capitalism and of
right.
having a massive redistribution of wealth in the United States and of paying reparations to people of African descent, short of those kind of long-term solutions, which I think really are the only solutions to this vast inequity of wealth that we see in the United States, what we could do, I think, in the short term to move us, to inch us towards greater equity would be a change in financing policies where we have financiers who are willing to take greater risk, where we have foundations that are willing to serve as the guarantor for financing for low and moderate income communities and people of color, where we see foundations who are willing to change kind of their grant-making policies so that they're providing longer-term funding instead of just 1 or 2 year grants. You know, many grassroots organizations need support for extended periods of time. Those funders can look at changing the way grants are evaluated so that the evaluation is more in tune with the needs of the people who are actually doing the work. Sometimes foundations tend to be disconnected from what's really happening on the ground and how people perceive their own needs. So, I mean, those are some short-term steps that I think could be taken to inch us towards greater equity. But even, I guess, the way you phrase the question, I find to be a bit troubling, where we're in a city that's 80% African-American, and then the question is, how do we kind of get the majority of the population more into the mainstream economy? And because that kind of incremental approach for me is just very troubling. And, I take the long view on this and look at it kind of historically, in terms of the history of African people in this country and this kind of constant incremental, the idea that we should move incrementally has not really served us well. And, part of what we try to do in the food movement is to radicalize the food movement, get people to see that what we need is a much more fundamental shift in wealth and these kind of just moving of small pots of money to communities that have been intentionally disinvested is not really going to get us to the equity that we like to see.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's talk about the nonprofit organization that you're leading right now, the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. How are you working with that organization, and what goals do you have?
Sure. So we started the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network in 2006. And we started in many ways as a result of me attending a conference of the Community Food Security Coalition in Atlanta in 2005. And that was the first time I'd been to a conference of that organization. And it just so happened that at that conference they were having this very intense discussion about race in the food system. And they had a whole tract of workshops that dealt with food and race that permeated this conference. And the organization, Community Food Security Coalition, at that time, had contracted with an anti-racist training organization called DR Works, Dismantling Racism Works, to both do training within the organization of the leadership and also to conduct these workshops at the conference. And so it was significant for me because what I saw was that what was happening across the country mirrored what I saw happening in Detroit, which was that most of the groups leading work that was being called food security work or urban gardening were well-meaning white-led nonprofit organizations who were getting grant funding to do work in either black or brown communities, which were described in grant applications in various ways, such as marginalized, at risk, or all of the other terms that I use to describe communities, again, which are intentionally disinvested. So we saw that same thing happening in Detroit. The major players in Detroit, which, again, at this time is a city that's at least 80% African-American, and in 2005 it was probably closer to 90%. So to have a vastly majority African-American city and to have all of the major players leading the work being whites was totally unacceptable for us. We believe in community self-determination, that communities have both the right and the responsibility to determine on their own what's in their own best interest and how they should meet their goals and aspirations. And so in many ways, that was the impetus for starting the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network so that we could ensure that the majority population in Detroit was playing a very active role in the food movement in Detroit, but also since we're in the vast majority of the population, that we were in the leadership of that movement. So since that time, we've done several things, including writing the food security policy for the city of Detroit, which we have passed unanimously by the city council in 2008. That policy called for the creation of the Detroit Food Policy Council, which we led the creation of in 2009, and I had the honor of chairing for its first 2 years. That organization now stands totally on its own, has its own board, its own funding sources, and continues to do good work in Detroit. We have, since 2006, led D-Town Farm, which is the largest farm in the city of Detroit. As you mentioned, it's a 7-acre farm where last year we grew more than 37 different crops. We have a youth program called the Food Warriors Youth Development Program, which helps young people between the ages of 7 and 12 at two locations in the city learn how to build raised bed gardens, how to harvest and prepare those foods in healthy ways. They learn about nutrition, and they learn how to be food justice advocates in their own community. And then finally, the big project we're working on is the Detroit Food Commons, new construction that we're leading right on the main street of Detroit, Woodward Avenue, the cornerstone of which will be the Detroit People's Food Co-op, a cooperatively owned grocery store.
That's great. We definitely need more of those everywhere, I think. Wow, you've
and, you
been
know,
busy.
Going back to your question about how, you know, in the face of this kind of rampant capitalism, you know, do we still make some progress short of kind of the total overhauling of the system? We think that cooperatives are also an important step, you know, because they're a way of communities being able to galvanize their collective wealth and to benefit collectively from it. And also it helps us to practice kind of grassroots democracy, since co-ops function on the one person, one vote principle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's, grassroots movement. It's so amazing to when you work with the grassroots movements, you know, and you have the one person, one vote reasoning. It feels so right, and you know, our system just feels so wrong. You know, when I used to go down to the protests down in, you know, the 1%. I'm having a brain.
Yeah, Occupy.
Occupy, yeah, you know, and,
right.
And you know, and everybody would, you'd see democracy in action, you know. It was just felt great. And it was so heartwarming to know that you had a place to go where that was alive and happening. And I was so sad to see it go. But it sounds like you're really building a movement there that is representative of your community, which is...
Yeah. And I don't want to give an overblown kind of impression of what we're doing, because what we're doing is still kind of embryonic given the total population of the city of Detroit. So we're making some inroads and trying to create a model and an example that we hope other people will replicate. But there's still a tremendous amount of work to do in Detroit. We're still not reaching, you know, the vast majority of the people in the city. So I just want to be clear, because sometimes people, you know, I've seen articles that say, you know, Malik Yakin is saving Detroit with kale. And, you know, these things just aren't, they're not true. We're taking small steps in the face of, you know, it's kind of like the biblical story of David and Goliath, actually.
Yeah. Well, like I was saying earlier, so much is about educating people about healthy eating and good food. And, you know, and I've seen it here, you know, it's very hard as a white person to try to, you know, to go into any community or to any group of people and say, this is what you're supposed to be eating. You know, who am I to say that? And, you know, everyone has to make their own choices. And it's really interesting, as someone that I am not a full vegan, you know, I believe plant-based eating is the healthiest. I haven't had meat or chicken in over 40 years, but I do eat seafood on occasion. I do eat dairy on occasion. And, you know, and for me, the middle road has worked better, you know, because I'm also a foodie. I enjoy food and I love going out with people and I love the pleasures around food. And so this is the balance that has worked for me. And I know my global footprint is a lot lighter than the majority of the people's because of my food choices, but it's not perfect. But we all have to...
You know, Bhavani, if I can interject, I was so happy to hear in your introduction, as you were talking about the conference and talking about the vegans who were upset because you have somebody presenting on sustainable meat. So I'm also vegan. Some people say I'm a vegan because occasionally I eat honey. But other than that, you know, I'm a pretty strict vegan. But I'm not... You know, some vegans, I think, are snobs, frankly, and are very judgmental about other people's food choices. So I was very happy to hear the way you framed that, you know, that we have to respect the choices that people make. I'm not necessarily convinced that veganism is the best thing for everybody, you know, it works well for me. But I think the thing is to be a conscious eater and a conscious purchaser of food, and to be aware of both the impacts it has on your individual health, but also to be aware of the environmental impact it has on the planet. So I'm just really happy with the way you frame that and the balance that you've been able to achieve and how you look at this.
Thank you. And it's challenging. You know, I've been really involved in slow food, and, you know, as someone that really also believes a lot in plant-based eating, you know, slow food has had a whole movement of slow meat. And, you know, when I was, you know, as chair, I was like, well, how do I get behind this, you know? And, you know, and yet I was able to get behind it because I know we're not going to turn everybody into plant-based eaters fully. So if they're going to be eating meat, let them know about the reality of making a better choice, you know. And then I was also reading about, you know, soil and farming and, you know, and there's people that talk about, you know, where the soil's really bad, the best way for replenishing the soil is to have animals grazing on it.
That's right.
And, you know, so they have, that's a symbiotic relationship that
absolutely
works in a permacultural biodynamic way. And so, you know, we have to be open. And I think anyone, you know, coming to anything when too much as a an all or nothing, you're not going to hear the other people, and you're not going to find that understanding that you need to bring to these issues, because they're all charged, you know.
Totally. I am totally with you. You know, at this point, I'm 62, and I would like to think that perhaps I'm wiser than I was 30 years ago. So I'm much less dogmatic and see things much less in polarities than I did 30 years ago, because it's, you know, the way the real world works, there's all these kind of gray areas in between. And so I just appreciate you having an understanding of those complications, and that it's not an all or nothing situation.
Yeah.
And that,
you know, you know what, it comes with our elder years. I'm right up there with you, Malik, so yeah. I get it. Anyway, this is a good time. Let's take a couple of minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about the work you're doing in building your food movement right there in Detroit. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Malik Yakini from the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. Be right back.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, the founder of the Progressive Radio Network. Today, we have more than 80 producers bringing forth the most progressive and most liberating information, the kind of information you do not regularly hear on any of the mainstream or alternative media. You can help us now. Up to this point, I have virtually supported the Progressive Radio Network, all of its expenses and payroll, myself. But we would like to expand our reach. We'd like to do far more. We'd like to be able to advertise on Facebook and let others know we exist. We are the number one progressive radio network in the world. In fact, we have programs that are most listened to in all of progressive radio. But we could go a lot further. Our message could reach a lot more people, especially at a time when people are desperate for honest, objective insights on the important topical issues of our day. How can you help? It's simple. Go to prn.fm, go to our main page. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a little button, Support Now. And then whatever you can contribute on a monthly basis will make a big difference. It will help get the message out. It will help inform more people, give them more choices. This is where you'll hear in the independent candidates and the people looking to challenge the corruption in government and industries. But we need to get our reach out further. So please, whatever you can afford on a monthly basis, and there's some suggestions there, and it'll be automatic. All right, thank you very much for continuing to help us help you and the rest of the world on these important issues.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Malik Yakini, the co-founder of the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. Malik, so yes. We were talking before the break about finding balance and the middle road a little bit.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit, other than anti-capitalism or other than getting rid of capitalism altogether, what are the major challenges that you really are facing in trying to improve the food movement there in Detroit?
So, of course, there's multiple challenges that we face. And so as you mentioned, I mean, there's the kind of systemic challenges that are constant. You know, the challenge of not having adequate access to capital within a system that concentrates capital in the hands usually of wealthy white men. There's that ongoing challenge. There's the ongoing challenge of living in a system of white supremacy that continues to give favor to people who are defined as white. But there's also, and this is not talked about quite as much, there's our own internal contradictions. And so, you know, I always look at both sides, the external contradictions and the internal contradictions. And, of course, it's much easier and sometimes it's much more fun to point fingers at the system that are oppressing us. And, you know, I get some joy in doing that and bashing capitalism and bashing white supremacy. But the reality is also we have a responsibility to transform ourselves. And so what I found is that many times in our organizations, we're bringing baggage to the organizational culture because of the damage that has been done to us or the dysfunction that exists within inside of us. And typically, the more people have been oppressed, and maybe I'm saying this, I'm going to rephrase this, that people who have been more oppressed exhibit certain types of dysfunction, because those who are in the more oppressive classes also have dysfunction, but perhaps it's slightly colored slightly differently. So we all have this kind of internal work to do. But what I found is that often our own internal baggage limits our ability to make the kind of progress that we like to see. For example, we bring with us often individualism to start with, this idea that our own limited perspective on the world is the right way to look at things. And we can often be very narrow and dogmatic within organizations and intolerant of other positions, and I think that's a limiting factor. Another factor that we often bring to this to organizational culture is envy and jealousy, that we're concerned that perhaps one person is, you know, a step ahead of somebody else, and that plays out within organizational culture. Sometimes, again, going back to the individualism, our unwillingness to submit to the will of the group if it doesn't align perfectly with our own ideas. And there's many other ways in which our own personal baggage manifests. You know, there's certainly patriarchy that plays out many times in organizations where men have not begun doing the work of personal transformation from the damage that's done to us from internalizing patriarchy. And so often we bring those kind of patriarchal attitudes unintentionally, unconsciously, to organizational culture. So sometimes men end up taking up all the air in the room. And so, you know, all of these kind of things are also some of the limiting factors. So, you know, again, there's the external contradictions, these big systemic things that we have to constantly work against, but also there's our own internal contradiction. And so the process of personal and group transformation and personal healing has to be an integral part of the food movement.
Yeah.
Let me be a little more specific, because sometimes I tend to go off into philosophical things and maybe I'm not addressing kind of some of the on-the-ground factors. So there's some real, you know, day-to-day challenges we're faced with as well. For example, for urban gardeners or urban farmers in Detroit, we have a tremendous challenge with water. Right now at our farm, for example, we have a 7-acre farm, and although we have a rainwater retention pond where we're able to capture some rainwater and reduce our use of municipal water, we still have three water lines where we have to pay water bills each month to the city water department. And about 75% of that bill is for sewerage, which is ridiculous because a farm is a permeable surface where we're not putting water into the stormwater management system, but we're diverting water from the system. And so that's a big fight in the city of Detroit, is particularly for some of the smaller gardeners who are not getting grants from foundations and have to pay these bills for the proceeds of what they're generating from growing produce. It becomes almost untenable to be able to pay these huge sewerage bills. So that's a major problem. There's also the problem of access to land, which is a problem both in urban and rural communities. In urban communities, as we see gentrification happening, typically municipal governments see gardening as a good temporary use until, in their minds, real development comes along. Real development meaning somebody who wants to build a parking structure or a housing complex or something like that. And so we see inequitable access to land to be able to do urban agriculture. There's also the problem of the infrastructure that's needed to support urban farmers and urban gardeners. You know, growing the food is one thing, but then you have to be able to wash, pack, and cool it quickly. You have to have vehicles that are able to transport the food from the place it's grown to the places it's either aggregated or sold on the retail level. And most of us just don't have that infrastructure in place. So there's multiple problems. There's a challenge in Detroit as we're building this cooperative grocery store of many people in the African community not in recent memory having been exposed to the cooperative food model. And so trying to shift people's thinking about how we obtain food, shifting from the kind of grocery store model where everybody's individually going and buying what they need for their own household to beginning to think about it on a more collective basis, how we, you know, aggregate our buying power to both be able to obtain food at a cheaper level, but also to control the means by which that food is provided. All of those are challenges that we're faced with here in the city of Detroit.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I talked about at the beginning when I was putting a call out to young people to innovate and come up with these ideas, and, you know, and I'm sure you see it too. I see so many great ideas happening with apps that are being developed of whether it's for food rescue or food distribution. And I'm just wondering, as you're saying that, you know, when you're talking about some of the infrastructure problems, I'm wondering, you know, if any of those could be solved with an app where, you know, someone could be picking the food up and taking it to somewhere where there's refrigeration and then it's being dispersed in a certain area that way. And, you know, if there's, you know, I don't really know the answer, but I'm certainly not one of those techie people. But
there are apps, and there have been some efforts to do that, primarily around aggregation of food and then getting it to individual customers. There's a few people who are doing that in southeastern Michigan. But even with the app, you still have to have the refrigeration. You have to have some place to take it to, you know, assuming people aren't going to pick it up as soon as it's picked. So you still need the infrastructure. The apps could certainly support that infrastructure and make it easier for people to access.
Yeah, definite challenges. Definite challenges. And are there partnerships that you have been able to develop where you feel support from other communities or within your community so that the partnerships can work together in this?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I just wanted to kind of balance the conversation by saying that, yes, there are challenges, but also there's tremendously positive things that are happening. And I think it's really important that we focus on those because particularly in this time period where we see so many regressive things happening, we can become very demoralized.
So, absolutely. That's what I was talking about at the beginning, too.
I heard that. I heard all of that. So, so it's important that we lift up the victories that we have and lift up the models that provide, you know, that are kind of like a lighthouse set up on a hill. And so, we have many partnerships. One of the most significant partnerships that we're part of is the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, which is led by our national organizer, Dara Cooper, who is a recent recipient of the James Beard Leadership Award. And within the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, we are organizing black farmers, black gardeners, black chefs, black food co-op operators, and black food activists throughout the country to be able to share skills and knowledge, and also to really look at how we build self-determined food economies in communities throughout the United States. So, you know, it's our analysis that living in a white supremacist system, that what black people and other people of color have to do is really bond together and kind of create mechanisms to empower the communities that we are part of. And this is why we see, for example, things like the Congressional Black Caucus, because they understand that within the context of a majority white system, that the way they're able to move the ball down the field is by black senators and Congress people banding together to work collectively. And that's why you have an association of black psychologists, so you have black police associations, because this is the way historically we have been able to gain some footing within a system that is largely geared against us. And so the National Black Food and Justice Alliance is a significant force in beginning to make that thing happen and looking at how we both share skills and knowledge. You know, if a farmer is having a particular challenge and another farmer in another part of the country, and figure out a solution to that, we need to figure out ways to share that knowledge. But also we understand that black people don't exist in a bubble, and then we have to have constructive relationships with others who are progressive and who have an understanding of how white supremacy functions. So, you know, we're all for allies, but we're for allies who are moving out of a place of understanding and not moving out of kind of a patriarchal or a standpoint that still positions them as the authority through which we're supposed to go through. So there's right. that. And locally, we have lots of partnerships as well. We partner, of course, with the Detroit Food Policy Council. We partner with many of the local growing organizations in the city of Detroit, such as Keep Growing Detroit, the Greening of Detroit, Earthworks Urban Farm. We partner with various groups like Fair Food Network, which has developed food bus in the city of Detroit and throughout the state of Michigan. We partner with various funders to try to create a more fair and just and equitable food system. So certainly this work is not work that any one organization can do. So we're really trying to look at how we have collective impact.
Mm-hmm. And what about your impact with schools? Are you making any inroads in schools to try to help? I know you said you have your youth programming at DFARM, but what about getting some of those programmings into schools? Any luck with that?
Our youth program currently functions at one school. We've been at several other schools in the city of Detroit, but what we found is that it's been very difficult for us to sustain the programming because there's such flux in public education in the city of Detroit. And I don't know how closely you followed that, but there has been, until recently, there was what was called an emergency manager appointed by the state whose powers superseded the powers of the elected school board. In fact, the elected school board wasn't even allowed to meet during this time when the emergency manager was in place. And there had been many principals that had been replaced. There were schools that were actually taken over. There was an alternative school system that ran parallel with the Detroit Public Schools, where failing schools were taken out of the Detroit Public School System and put into this alternative school system run by the state. And so that kind of flux and constant changes in the school system has impacted our ability to have long-term programming in schools. So we've been in at least seven or eight schools over the last 5 years, but many of those schools have closed or had changes in leadership, which required us to leave. So we're currently in one school, which is a charter school called Timbuktu Academy of Science and Technology on the east side of Detroit. It's an African-centered school that tries to situate African-American children within their own cultural and historical continuum. And we come in and we do an after-school program teaching them how to grow food and also the relationship of farming and food works to traditional African cultures and African American culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have read about the public school problems there.
Mm-hmm.
tough, really tough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to get into public schools here, even when they're not going through such problems, you know? You know, because the teachers are so overworked and they're so responsible for this stupid testing and, you know, they just have testing on the brain and, you know, and forget about how the real learning happens with their hands, and it's a problem.
Well, if I can add one more thing, because your question, I think, was specifically about how our organization has been successful or not in penetrating the public schools. But I do have to say that until last year, we had, for the last 6 or 7 years, a woman who headed the Detroit Public Schools lunch program, who absolutely spearheaded creating gardens in many schools around the city of Detroit. And there's one large farm called the Drew Farm that's at a school that's growing huge amounts of food. So the school system itself, in spite of our difficulty in penetrating it, there was a person on the inside who was able to make absolutely wonderful changes and in many ways create a model for what public education should do. So, you know, Detroit is varied and complex, and I just want to make sure I put that aspect out there as well.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. That's great news. So we're just about out of time. Can you please, before we sign off, share with everyone your organization's website? And I'm sure as a nonprofit, you do take donations so people can...
We absolutely do.
...and help support
donations.
Your work.
Yes, thank you, Bhavani. So the Detroit Black Community Food Security Network can be contacted via our website, which is www.dbcfsn. And again, that's the initials of our organization, Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. So it's dbcfsn.org. And on our page, there's a donate button. We certainly encourage and appreciate any donations that people would make that helps to sustain our work. Or they can call us at our office at area code 313-345-3663. Again, that's area code 313-345-3663. We're also on Facebook under Detroit Black Community Food Security Network. We would encourage people to follow us on Facebook. We're on Instagram and Twitter, but we haven't really done as much with those platforms as we should. So Facebook is the social media platform we're most active on.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And I'll share it on my website so everyone can have those contacts. And
thank
Malik,
you so much.
Thank you for giving your time and joining
Bhavani.
This morning. It's wonderful, and I hope I see you again soon here in New York
or in Detroit.
Thank
you for all the wonderful work you're doing, and I wish you a wonderful conference this weekend. Please give my love to Karen Washington.
I will. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everyone out there, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. See you all again next week.